I would now go ahead and request Daniel to first begin presenting his work, what he's been doing, and then followed by Steven, and then we could probably, if Hassini joins us, she could come up in the end and present her work.
Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you to the Hub for the invitation to speak today. It's really a pleasure for me to share some work in progress with you today and to speak alongside Stephen and Asini, who are friends and partners in a different but very much related project. Now, the subject of this talk is very much a work in progress, so I will welcome feedback from the audience on the ideas that I will be sharing. I will be discussing a documentary film, which we are in the process of making, on mass graves from the Lebanese Civil War. A film made of voices and landscapes, testimonies and places. And the film is part of a wider project led by myself for the UK and Dr. Carmen Abou-Jaoudi in Beirut for Lebanon, funded by the British Academy. So I'd like to acknowledge the funder here. It's called Memories from the Margins, and it's around informal personal archives and oral narratives as ways to explore bottom-up practices that challenge hegemonic discourses of conflict, of memorializations of conflict. There's a website, memorymargins.com, if you're interested in more information. Specifically, the side of the project that I'll discuss today relates to the more than 100 unmarked burial sites that have been located in Lebanon, dating back to the 75-1990 civil war that has claimed around 250,000 lives, and after which there have been around 17,000 disappeared that are unaccounted for today. Now, with each passing year, the preserving evidence that could clear up the fate of the missing becomes more difficult, and witnesses who have crucial information also are growing older. I'm talking about, in particular, former fighters who might have perpetrated some of the massacres, some of the killing, and the burial site themselves are steadily being destroyed as new construction sites emerge on the ruins or on the grounds of suspected or confirmed mass graves. So the film really tries to produce, on the one hand, a record, a lasting record of these sites and the stories and the history that they reveal and conceal. It does so by using information developed by mainly civil society, because the state has not really done any work around this issue, and by working in partnership with an NGO called Act for the Disappeared, which is one of the few NGOs that have done work on burial sites, on mass graves. The sites are obviously often very sensitive, politically very sensitive. They're either under threat or already been lost to new residential and commercial developments. And therefore, the production of a record around these sites is of particular importance, precisely because they could reveal something of the fate of the 17,000 disappeared, a dossier that remains opened and for which there has been so far no resolution. Not only were these individuals' lives taken away anonymously, meaning no one claimed their death, but the death and the memory of these deaths were also eliminated, precisely because they were then laid in unmarked burial sites. And the victims were therefore subjected to what one could call forms of asocial death. Death robbed of its meaning as the end of a fulfilled life. Because of this context, the film relies mainly on the power of landscape. And so it reuses landscapes and accounts of witnesses to bring back to visibility that which lays beneath the surface. Now, Lebanon, unlike other countries that have witnessed similar moments, periods of violence, such as Peru, Guatemala, Bosnia and Herzegovina, has no exhumation but two have ever been carried out. So exhumations, remains have not been exhumed, and the state, or the post-conflict state, has not really embarked in any process of accounting and even locating the mass graves. So exhumations have only taken place in a handful of cases, mainly when they involved foreign nationals, British nationals, for instance, or French nationals, under pressure from foreign governments, the French and the British government. And exhumation of mass graves remain a taboo. An issue that is rarely discussed, and around which there really is very little accountability and transparency. And why are exhumations so opposed? Well, because, of course, they would open up the space for new representations of past events. And, of course, because the state fears an uncontrolled recovery of the past, one that would, of course, by recomposing the shattered intimacy between the body and the name, would force the resurfacing of a discussion around not only the civil war, but the transition to peace. So what the film is trying to do is precisely to produce a lasting record, but also to attempt, in collaboration with civil society and with the families of the disappeared, to re-signify the sites of mass killing. So to rearrange, as it were, the visibility of suffering. So what I would like to very briefly introduce today is how is the film going about doing this? And what strategy as filmmakers are we planning to use, or are we reflecting on? Now, the locations of these mass graves look something like these. I'm going to share my screen in a moment. I hope you can see my screen. Can you all see my screen? Someone could nod. Yes, that's great. So they look something like this, meaning that they bear pretty much no trace, no evidence of what has happened. I'll show you another one. I hope you can see. So when we visit these locations and we make images of these landscapes, we don't really see very much. And yet we know by context, and in the film we'll know because of the voices that we hear, that they are sites of atrocities. So we know that as filmmakers, we are confronting atrocities, but we are confronting without being able to show, say, the graphic traces of the violence that's been committed or even of its aftermath. In fact, we see nothing. We see the absence of traces of violent acts. And we don't see victims and we don't see perpetrators. So what do we see? We see a fairly ordinary, mundane landscape, sometimes rural, sometimes urban. The burial sites are scattered around the country in different kind of location, with very little of notice. But we do know that this is a site where evidence of atrocity has been deliberately destroyed. So what becomes visible through these images, through these landscapes, where what we see is very little, where we see hardly any trace? What we do see is precisely an invisibility, an invisible violence, or rather violence made invisible. And it is this act of making the violence invisible by hiding bodies, by disappearing them, by burying them in our marked sites, by literally hiding death. It's this production of invisibility that the film tries to contend with, or tries to address, to film the absence of evidence in order to make the violence that perpetrators wanted to hide visible again, to bring the act of making violence invisible, visible again. So the image makes visible that violence that was meant to be hidden and erased. And so addresses directly the fact that The violence was meant to leave no trace, was meant to disappear, and therefore to perpetuate itself in even stronger terms, precisely because not evident, precisely because it is destruction, as it were. So we're here trying to deal with the double violence, the one perpetrated on bodies that were killed, kidnapped most of the time, sometimes tortured, and then dumped in mass graves. And then the violence perpetrated even on the possibility to remember these acts, and more important, to remember their victims. Once the violence is hidden, once the violence is erased, there is a second moment of violence against the possibility to memorialize what has happened. So the hiding of violence constitutes not merely an erasure, but a doubling of the violence itself. So what the image tries to do is to make visible once again precisely this hiding of the atrocity, precisely the fact that the atrocity was meant to be unrecoverable, was meant to go beyond the threshold of the detectability. So the image does carry this invisibility, does not try, say, to produce evidence or to manufacture it through, say, I don't know, reconstructions or even archive material. But precisely because of that, the lack that is at the heart of the image, it tries to mobilize, point to the fact that if only we could look differently, if only we could look beneath the surface, we would find some evidence there. So I hope I'm not running too late. I can't see any message in the chat, so I feel like I'm still okay to go.
10-minute mark.
10-minute mark, okay. So the image, in a way, holds together and tries to recompose both the extreme and the everyday. The extreme of an atrocity that we know has been committed there, and the everyday, the mundanity, the, if you want, even the banality of a landscape that now shows no traces. And so it is the invisibility that the image carries that is trying to point us to what has happened, to the doubling of the violence, to the hiding of the violence. So I'm going to try to compress and rush to a conclusion. So what do these landscapes reveal? They reveal themselves as what one could call forensic monuments. So sites not framed by human agency. There is no reminder there that something has happened. There is no memorialization that something has happened, but marked by various environmental agents, for instance, the vegetation or geophysical anomalies that the forensic experts we're working with are able to detect even at the naked eye. So these kind of forensic monuments, even when abandoned or not commemorated, maintain, are still hallmarked by the presence of human remains, and therefore continue to exert some kind of an affective impact. So what can film do, given that the question for today was, you know, how can the arts contribute to a memorialization of aspects that are beyond visibility or before visibility or that are not so immediately evident? With this film, what we're trying to do is to make visible the violence that was deliberately made invisible by working not according to a homogeneous method, but through dissonance. The dichotomy between what is seen on the surface and what is known through the voices that we hear about the image's context creates a space where the viewer starts to work or has to work to make sense of what the play sees or does. And this disturbance, this jarring, this juxtaposition between the nothing of the image and the context that bears so much affective impact, such atrocious history, is what sets the film to work. There's a quiet, ordinary, mundane surface on which there seemed to be very little to register, very little to see. And this surface begins to be exhumed, not by a bulldozer or by a radar, but by the patience of the camera and by the words of the witness. And I think I'll close here for now, and we can discuss the rest maybe in the Q&A. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Danielle. We have Hasini here with us, and she might have to leave in 20 minutes. Is it okay, Stephen, if I ask her to go now after Danielle, and you could go after that?
No problem.
Thank
yeah.
you. Thank Please. You so much. Thank you. Allow me to introduce Hasini. Hasini Habbutantri is a part of a global network of practitioners on peace building, education, cultural and heritage management. She has over 15 years of experience in international development, out of which she worked as a technical advisor to GIZ for 10 years. Since 2017, she has been an independent consultant working with a host of local and international organizations, addressing the challenges of global-local nexus in establishing a culture of peace. Welcome, Hasini. It's great to have you here. And tell us, what are you working on?
Thank you, Garima. Thank you. I think I'm going to share some of the ongoing work that I have been involved in on the field of history and memory, especially related to art. So I have been working with a group of artists and curators and educators from around the world, which is actually from seven different countries, who have come together and have been working on an initiative called World Art and Memory Museum. And we've been trying to really promote how we can use art as a form of memorialization and history writing as well, and actually as something that can bridge the divide between these two. And what I would like to speak today is on art of witness, and asking a somewhat provocative question of how we bridge the this difference between history and memory by bringing in art into this whole discussion. So if it is all right, may I share the presentation and start with it? Yeah? Okay. Let me try to share the PowerPoint. Share screen. Do you see my screen now? It's okay, Garima? Yeah, okay.
Yes.
So as I said, I want to see how art can work as a way of history writing and history teaching, as well as bridging this divide between art and memory. So I really start every time with a personal point of reference, and that being how I got attracted to art, especially also by studying art history. So when you are talking about the past, which is somewhat of a different concept than history and memory, we find that there are so many different subjects that are related to the study of the past, and one is art history. And if you study art history, you will approach history and the past and memory through a slightly different angle, through a slightly different medium. And wherever you are in the world, you will have a different route to understanding, documenting, representing, and communicating the history. So I want to start with a provocative question, and that is art history? You know, because we have art, we have history, we have archaeology, we have art history. So these are all very different disciplines. And the very fact that this question is provocative means that when you say art and history, but the art can actually be a part of history, separate from art history, your feedback or your response is not always clear, because a lot of the time art is seen not as a very objective way of approaching things. So I quote from W.M. Meister, who in his beautiful article that he wrote for Romila Thapar's Felicitation volume, actually recalls his own memories of being a history graduate at Harvard, and says how better the literature, the less it might offer as a historical substance. This whole idea of things that start from a more subjective point as having lesser value when it comes to recording history and recording the past. So literature, art, they all start from a very different personal perspective. But this is where I start to really address the whole idea of objectivity, especially, for instance, how we can be really objective when we are recording things, when we are writing things, especially history. And I always go back to this saying by E.H. Carr, there are facts and there are historical facts. And who decides what is a historical fact from a fact? For instance, let's look at this painting of Julius Caesar crossing the Rubicon, right? So a lot of people crossed the Rubicon. That's a fact, not just Julius Caesar. There are so many people who crossed it. But the fact that Julius Caesar crossed it becomes a historical fact. And how does it happen? By the fact that a historian, a writer, an artist chooses this incident over everybody else who crossed the Rubicon to be represented for a future generation. So in itself, we have this whole question of objectivity, where you are actually making a very subjective decision of choosing certain facts over the others to give them more weight as a part of history. And then we also have the hurdle of divided disciplines, which also contributes to this this dichotomy of divided disciplines and trying not having an overview of the past and way we relate to it. And all of these are embedded in our historical, educational structures. When we look at history books, when we look at museums, when we look at television dramas and historical dramas and movies that we consume every day, we see that certain narratives are privileged and represented and re-narrated again and again and again over the others. And I'm going to also draw from some of the art that's shown on our World Art and Memory Museum collaborative as I go through these explanations. So then I think it's important to understand history as a small piece of the puzzle, especially the academic approach of history, which is more the domain of historians, art historians, or museologists and archaeologists. But this is a very small piece of the past. There are other versions which are political and ideologically generated past. And then there is also the past of the common man. And this is the idea of the practical past, which I really find interesting, because this is a concept that for me bridges the divide between the more objective, grand narrative history with that of memory and lived reality and people. So Michael Oakeshott's idea of practical past is something that I really keep returning to in trying to bridge this divide. So in his words, it's the version of the past that most of us carry around with us in our minds and draw on in the performing of our daily tasks, where we are compelled to judge situations, solve problems, make decisions. It is made up of all those memories and illusions, bits of vagrant information, attitudes and values. So practical past is something that is a functional version of the past that all of us carry within us. It's made up of fairy tales that we would have heard as kids, murals that we've seen in our temples or churches that we visited while growing up, what we consume on television and history books and textbooks and museums. So it's made up of all of this, which is functional for each individual in a given moment. And I want to come to this final point of making history and art as representation. So history is not the past. History is a representation of a past, and it can be mediated by evidence, methodology, ideology, and subjectivity. Meanwhile, art is also a representation of the past. So that is why I find art very, very subtle and enriching when we treat it as a method of representing and engaging with the past. For instance, we have this, what you're seeing right now is a painting called Lebanese War Statistics by Nada Sehnai, from a Lebanese artist. So she is basically showing how the presentation of the Lebanese war has led to the naturalizing the tragedy and the trauma of it. So when every death is just a statistic, is rendered a statistic, how people can become desensitive to it. So she's just making marks to show that the death count. And so this is why I find that artists have a way of capturing emotions that often do not have place in history books and even museums at times. And they have a way of capturing the nuances, the emotions, the values and the attitudes that are embedded in a certain event and bring them out and bring it out onto the table and for our reflection. So, and situating art as a product of historical discourses is interesting, and understanding art also as something that disseminates and contributes to historical discourses are interesting. For instance, let's take this example from Sri Lanka. The artist is Jagat Veerasinghe. It's called Who Are You, Soldier? So basically, Jagat is trying to represent the young soldiers in Sri Lanka, usually drawn from the rural lower middle income communities. So what the army did for all these rural youth and masses is in a way to give them a common identity while somewhat erasing their own individuality. So you cannot see his face anymore. The young man, his face is not there anymore, but he does have a new identity, you know, and that he is asking, who are you, soldier, through this painting. So art then becomes a way of reflecting what's happening in the society, but also asking questions and trying to reflect what a society is going through on another dimension that is thought provoking. So let's get back to a mainstream example of how this whole approach changed if you take it from an art historical point of view. I'm taking you to this famous painting by François Girard. So this is just a European art history. If you do a BA in art history, this is normal stuff that you would go through. So you see how history is always depicted. It's written by the victor. You can see them in the limelight, heroes on horseback. It's their story. You can see the victims at the bottom of the painting. They are usually in the dark. You can't see them quite well. So this is usually the way that grand narratives have been being represented in literature, in art, in history, everywhere. And this is a very familiar version of history that we often see, and the history that we are trying to contest through initiatives like ours and in group discussions like these. And then here is another painting that really made a difference in terms of European art history. It's the 3rd of May, 1808, called François de Goya. I mean, these two paintings are around about the same time. This is 1810, but here is 1808, it's slightly 2 years older. So Goya depicts history from a very different point of view. Here there are no heroes on horseback, you can't see their faces. It's very dark, depressing environment that you see. What you are seeing is just victims, actually, and you see their faces, you see their emotions, and you see a gruesome act being committed. So this was a huge turning point in art history. The fact that you really chose to look at history from a very different point of view. And this sort of was the precursor for modern history, modern art in this, what we saw in 20th century and 21st century more or less. So let's look at how this influences another very well-known artist in our world. This is Picasso's version of Massacre in Korea. So you can see how Goya is really leading the way for Picasso to address modern history and especially issues like genocide. You know, so it's Massacre in Korea. And you can also see this, the relationship this has to his very famous painting, Guernica. So this is how, I'm just giving you a very mainstream example where everyone can relate to this. And now I just want to give you a few examples from the artists that we are working with from our initiatives. By the way, how much time do I have, Garima? Like maybe 2 minutes, 3 minutes? How am
okay,
I doing?
You're already on 12 minutes now. In fact, over 12 minutes. I was about to actually ask you, is it possible if we could wrap this up in another 30 seconds to 1 minute? Because I have to then give time to Stephen, who's next. Yes.
Yeah. So what I would advise you is to take a look at some of the paintings that are being depicted in World Art and Memory Museum. It's www.wammuseum.org. You will find more information there. I'm not going to explain any of them. I'm just going to show you some examples of them. So to wrap up, how do we move towards a history or a version of the past that matters and is inclusive of memory of different versions and gives us a space to question and reflect? And art can make a huge contribution towards this end by recording not just fact, but also emotion and thereby grounding empathy and critical attention. So that is basically what I really wanted to focus on. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Up next, we have Stephen. And to all those who have joined us a little later, I would quickly tell you, Stephen is director of Amani Institute, Uganda, and he's currently senior advisor, legal and constitutional affairs at the reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Committee in Juba, South Sudan. And he is also the co-investigator on Beyond War Compensation, Gender Justice, Livelihood and Rights in Northern Uganda. And it's a collaborative research project being undertaken with the College of for Humanities and Social Sciences at the Makerere University. Stephen, over to you.
Thank you very much, Garima. Thank you, everyone. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, whatever you are. I welcome this opportunity to share some insights on the work that Amani Institute Uganda is also doing at the moment, alongside our core hub project with Makerere University, the Beyond War Compensation. Today, I want to reflect a bit on a very new project that we are undertaking under the Performing Violence and Gendering Change Project, with the gracious support of Danielle Hugo there. The project seeks to revisit, analyze, reproduce in video, and translate two very interesting local songs performed in Nanga. Nanga is a harp, an 8-string musical instrument, which is very common in Acholi, alongside the other musical instruments that we have. And Nanga is special because it is taken as a notebook or a journal that is used in Acholi to record historical events which are very significant at personal and community levels within Acholi. This particular project that we are doing is inspired by our ongoing project that we call Acholi Oral History Archive, or ACOA project, known locally as Abogalam. Abogalam is basically to say it's difficult to narrate the story. You need to have experienced it. You need to have seen it. You need to have heard it to be able to appreciate some of these significant events. And as a result, Amani is collecting, documenting, and preserving oral narratives and history, including Acholi literature, Acholi songs, interesting photos and artifacts. As we speak now, we have about 300 local songs that we have archived in our database. And why is this important? In relation to the war, the over 2-decade conflicts that happened in Northern Uganda between the Lord's Resistance Army and the government of Uganda, I personally and Namani Institute as an organization, we feel very strongly that this war is one of the most misunderstood war in history. And this is partly because the war was fought in darkness with a total media blockade from the government in Kampala at the time, and also because of a lack of proper documentation, which is largely a result of our deeply entrenched oral tradition. Even though there's been a lot of research that has already been done in Northern Uganda, mainly by external researchers visiting the region, some of the problems that the previous speakers have talked about, including methodology, choices, preconceived narratives, victors' narratives, tend to dominate the accounts and findings of these researchers. And a lot of hidden, uncommon narratives, which are a reflection of what the people actually went through. And these do not feature in many of the research that have been conducted in the region. And as a result, they are missing in the dominant narratives. And a lot of time, these oral narratives, which lived, experienced, and shared through stories, through songs, through proverbs or recitals in nangas, as opposed to writing down, tend to either disappear or get lost in translation over time, which are some of the dangers of oral narratives tradition. And in Acholi, for example, the elders and even the artists tend to speak in proverbs, what we call charolok, or in recitals, what we call luod. And as a result of that, you need some very careful interpretation to really get the deeper meaning of what the elders are saying or what the artists are singing about. And many researchers miss this as a result, because they come for a few days, months, and they tend to use translators. And as I said, a lot is lost in translation. The two songs that we have selected are very interesting in terms of their account of what happened during the internal displacement era in Northern Uganda, when people were in the internally displaced persons camps, and there were widespread and systematic violence, human rights violations by the soldiers, as well as sexual and gender-based violence perpetrated by both the state and non-state actors, as well as among us, the community. And whenever we listen to this song again and again, as well as ask some of the people who were there at the time when these events were happening, we have begun to discover some very detailed accounts of the systemic nature and prevalence of sexual and gender-based violence that happened at the time, during the displacement, during the war, including very interesting insights on who the perpetrators were, the causes, as well as the impact. Now, as I say, this is an ongoing project, and we haven't reached a stage where we can share it. We have a rough cut, and we expect in a couple of months, this will be shared with all the HAP members and the participants in this. But the first song that we are working on is called Adek Kayola Pamony. Adek Kayola Pamony, loosely translated, means I hate these operations by the soldiers. Now, you need to understand what Kayola is. Kayola used to be an operation mounted by the soldiers at the wee hour of the morning. Around 4 a.m., the soldiers would deploy in a particular village and arrest every male, young female, youth, suspected to either be a rebel collaborator or somebody who was once in the army. The people would be gathered and taken to an assembly point, and there would be identification parade. Now, even if somebody suspects you to having any network or brother or sister in the rebel camp, you would be arrested and bundled up in a very long lorry that they call Kayola. So the Kayola was both the operation in the morning, collecting people and taking them in the assembly point. And then the Kayola was also the long NRIA, now UPDF truck, a Mercedes doll at the time, which was used to carry soldiers. And in this instance, they would carry any suspected rebel collaborators and basically take them to unknown destination. Some ended up in Luzira, others were never found to death. The other song, Deck of Kanoga, Ugoyadong Pilamo Jiri, talks about a man called Kanoga who was living in the IDP camp and who became very violent on his wife, beating her at every instance, mainly because of silverfish, very small fish, which ordinarily would have been ignored. But at any slight provocation, this man would basically turn on his wife and beat him. So the second song basically talks about domestic violence in the context of the IDP camps. And the first song talks about a military operation by the UPDF soldiers. And I will only take you through some of the major verses of these songs at this stage, because I cannot play it for you. It's in Acholi. We have translated it, but we haven't produced the final video. So starting with Adek Kayola Pamon, which is, I hate the operation of the soldiers. This artist, who is a very well-renowned Nanga artist in Northern Uganda, who unfortunately died under very mysterious circumstances, again called Jago Palo A, expresses his disappointment at first how he was being mistreated. First by his father-in-law, who he accused of having taken his eight goats and refusing him to marry his daughter. The father-in-law took his goats and refused his marriage. He refused him to take the wife. And this was the second wife. The second one, in the second verse, he laments at this operation by the military, by the government forces, which he says is so painful. And he pins this Kayola to the era of a commander called Sereko. He alleged that on this fateful night or morning, his wife was taken, kept away for about two nights. He was left alone, thinking about her. He summoned the courage and decided to follow his wife. On that instance, he met his wife at the gate of the soldiers, what he called the barracks or the detached. The wife looked so miserable. She looked like she was bitten by mosquitoes. She looked like she was burned by sun. Her buttocks looked flattened. Her back had grass. And between her thighs looked shiny clean, as if the soldiers had stolen her. That's why he hates this operation of the soldiers and said, look, this kind of operation we were used to, graduated tax collectors. At least we prefer the operation of tax collectors, but the ones of the soldiers must be stopped. In verse 3, he adds that when he met his wife, he found the back was dirty because he was lying in the andaki, something where the soldiers used to sleep. The breast had sweat, even the legs looked tired. He asked her, but she never said anything. He checked in between her thighs and found it was clean and shiny. And he had no doubt that the soldiers had stolen her. By stealing her, it basically meant the soldiers had raped her, his wife. In verse 4, he complains of the other atrocities that the soldiers had committed. He said, his chicken were full in the arch, but he only got the feathers because the soldiers had taken them all. He had goats which were full in the shed, but he only found their footmark as all were taken by the soldiers. He asked, why do this? Why are they doing this to the people in Northern Uganda? And these were directly aimed at the government forces. And I will show you later how you cannot find these incidents in the contemporary narrative or in the dominant narratives, where the state was presented as the protector, the government soldiers were presented as the saviors, and there were a group, of course, the Lord's Resistance Army, who were portrayed as the killers, the rapists, and all sorts of violations. In the second song, which I talked about, how this man called Kanoga beat his wife, Adong, because of this small fish. We call it Lamojiri or silver fish. He sang about how men had changed because of the war and the encampment and become shameless and violent. He called upon the women to see what is happening to men, to find out why have men becoming this cruel, you know, actually something which was not heard of. Men were them protectors, loving, but during the war, during the IDP camp, they became the tormentors. And Kanoga is appealing to women to find out what is bringing the curse of beating women. How are women being beaten because of a small thing like this silver fish, which cannot even dig for you a garden? He's basically saying this has no value. This fish has no value. But the context in which Kanoga sang this, I mean, Jagopalaye sang this song, is because the Acholi men were great hunters. They were the providers. But as a result of the encampment, only women were allowed to go out of the camp to look for food. So women became the providers. Men were not allowed to visit their old homestead. They could not dig. At least women were allowed. The soldiers would allow women to go. And of course, when they go collecting firewood, they go digging in their homestead, they would be arrested. Some of them would be raped, and they would still come back home and keep quiet about the incident because they didn't want to ruin their marriages. So Adong, the lady in question, the wife of Kanoga, was beaten for almost every slight provocation because of maize, because of silverfish, because of beans, and the neighbors would hear her crying every time about something to eat. So the artist was basically appealing to men to appreciate every little effort that the women were making and to try to eat whatever is presented to them and not be violent, because they are making a bad situation worse. In fact, in the song, there are also lyrics about what was happening to men themselves. In verse 3, Jagopalaye laments at how this small fish with eyes that are wide open like lagoon. Now, lagoon is a very interesting analogy that he uses in this song. Lagoon portrays a man who was being raped. And there's a widespread documented incidents of male rape by the NRA soldiers in Northern Uganda between...
Stephen, I think, I'm sorry, I might have to interrupt you here because it's already over 14 minutes. So I would request you to quickly wrap up, because then we would have to open it to the audiences for their questions. And we have a few questions for all of you.
Thank you very much. I will basically conclude by demonstrating some of the dominant narratives on conflict-related SGBV in Northern Uganda, as well as some of the hidden narratives that Jagopalaye is bringing out. I mean, everyone knows in Northern Uganda, when you talk about SGBV, that the LRA abducted thousands of women and children, that the women and girls were raped in captivities, in IDP camps, that the LRA enslaved women, that the women were denied property rights, that women were being beaten by men. But these narratives are the ones that shaped even the pursuit of justice. And I think a classical case is the recent ICC verdict on Dominic Ongwen, which I think not only entrenched this Dominic narrative, but also exonerated the state or the government of Uganda and government soldiers for that. The verdict therefore legalized the dominant narrative of the LRA as guilty of all these forced marriages, torture, rape, sexual slavery, enslavement, forced pregnancy, outrages upon personal dignity, but said nothing about the violence perpetrated by the state. So very little is known about the fact that the state or government forces equally committed all, if not worse, some of this SGBV against both men and women in Northern Uganda. Thank you very much. I will respond to, I'll add more during the Q&A.
Yeah, we hardly have time left for it. We just, we only have maybe 4 minutes and we have a few questions here. Daniel, there is one question from Dr. Neelam Rayana for you. How do you place this in relation to transitional justice and its relevance and applicability to Lebanon, especially in contrast to how there are mass burials in developed world, example being Canada? And there is another question from Marta Mendes. Thank you for your presentation, Daniel. How have you tried to incorporate the concept of spectralities, not there, invisible beings, but existent nonetheless, in the making of the documentary you told us about? These are two questions for you. I have one for Stephen as well. I hope I'm able to take that. And one for Hasini, but I don't know if she's here.
How long do I have to answer?
Oh, well.
5 seconds, 10 seconds.
No. 1 minute, maybe 2 minutes.
So in terms of transitional justice, so part of the work we're doing is a kind of action work, meaning that research action, because Lebanon has just established a national commission for the disappeared. The work of the film and the evidence that the film will gather will be made available to the commission as and when. But in particular, by making a record now, whatever destruction occurs in the next few years before the commission gets to work on the dossier, the film will be able in a way to contribute and to be used as evidence despite or regardless of the destruction that happens in the meantime. So there is an important element there of contributing to one of the pillars of transitional justice, at least, and that is that of accountability, meaning something has happened here, we can show you that this landscape looks like this for a particular reason. So this is very brief, a very brief answer. The question around spectrality, yes, as I hinted already in the chat, it's one that is very important for us because, of course, the invisibility we talk about, the invisibility that the image, that the film tries to incorporate rather than do away with, is as also its own materiality. In particular, when erasure is the result of a deliberate action, it becomes material. It is still there, as it were. And we are trying precisely to address that, to address the fact that the fact that you can't see anything in the landscape is the result of a deliberate action. So the invisibility has built itself into the landscape, into the way the landscape look. The lack of traces, the absence of traces, is not just the result, say, of time eroding or cancelling. It is the result of a deliberate action to conceal. So it constitutes itself into something material that you can see in the landscape. I hope this goes somewhere near that.
Yes, I think that was, it could be as short as this. I think you could go on and on this. We have a question for Hasini, but she's not here, but it was a relevant one. If somebody could, how can we exhibit and get involved in the WAM Museum? So maybe if we could pass on her email, you could write to her, Biscare. And now for you, Stephen, we have two questions. I'm just clubbing them together. One from Mario Gomez. He says, memory work and art dealing with memory probably has to engage with victim expectations. Does this raise an additional challenge? And how does one manage these expectations? And another one is from Josephine Hekir. And the question is, Stephen, how can you we use these stories? How can these stories be used to create momentum for transitional justice and return to social relevant cohesion, social relative cohesion? So I'll wrap up after this. I'm sorry, I cannot take any more questions.
Thank you very much. I think I'll start with the second question. How can these stories be used to create momentum for transitional justice? I think Uganda, unfortunately, has been piloting or experimenting transitional justice without any significant transition per se, and the same actors are very much in charge, or at least available and obstructing at every opportunity progress towards transitional justice. A policy process was hijacked and not much has come out of it, except for anecdotal attempts, both at the International Crimes Division, the ICC, as well as local community initiative. The appetite or the environment at the moment has certainly grounded transitional justice initiatives to a near halt. What can happen is this kind of creative attempts to preserve the evidence, to document, and certainly whenever an opportunity arises, there will be plenty of justification for, you know, looking back and dealing with some of these unaddressed legacies of the violence. On the question of how to manage victims' expectation, that remains an enduring challenge in all transitional justice initiatives, whether international criminal justice, whether local trials, whether community documentation like we are trying to do. And certainly one way is to engage them and be very honest that we are putting a piecemeal here, doing what we can in the circumstances, hoping that gradually there'll be a critical mass to demand for justice and that will happen. Thank you.
Thank you. And with this, we wrap the event. Thank you so much. Thanks to all our speakers and audiences. We would also request you to follow our Hub Twitter page, which is @GCRF Gender Hub, where we would be making the recording of this event available first and on our YouTube channels as well. And our next public event is tomorrow, 29th July, 1 p.m., that is British summer time. And it is on Columbia Today, a balance of where we are, what has been achieved, and what are ongoing challenges from the perspective of policymakers. So please do sign up for that. Thanks again. Thank you, Daniel. Thank you, Stephen, Becca, Evelyn, everyone at the GCRF Gender Hub. Hafini, thank you so much. And what a learning experience for me as well. I really thank you all for this opportunity. Thank you so much.